Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm series co-host Dave Anderson, and today I'm speaking with Jefferson Cowie, the James G. Stallman Professor of History at Vanderbilt University. He's the author of Capital Moves, RCA's 70-Year Quest for Cheap Labor, Staying Alive, the 70s and the Last Days of the Working Class, The Great Exception, The New Deal and the Limits of American Politics, and most recently, Freedom's Dominion, a saga of white resistance to federal power, published by Basic Books. Hi, Jeff, and welcome to the Working History Podcast.
Hey, Dave, it's great to be here.
Let's dive right in and talk about the book. Your book explores the multiple meanings and uses of freedom, expressed often as a form of racialized anti-statism that kept the federal powers at bay, or more bluntly, white resistance to federal power. And you illustrate this theme through the history of one southeastern Alabama county from the 1830s to the 1960s, from Andrew Jackson's Indian removal policy up to Reconstruction, the Jim Crow era, the New Deal, the Civil Rights Movement, and George Wallace's presidential campaigns. So it's a big book with a large scope. What's the book's origin story? Could you tell us how you came up with this idea and why Barbour County?
Oh, right. Yeah. So that's a great question. There's two prongs to that. Why the theme and why the place? The theme I've been thinking about for a long time, especially from my experience in labor history, is so much of labor history pivots on the state, and yet federal power is always, we're always suspicious of federal power. Workers are suspicious of federal power. There's an entire American tradition of fear and loathing of federal power. And so that had always been spinning around in my head. And then I began to sort of notice invocations of the word freedom in ways that basically scared me, you know, even though I regard freedom as, you know, an important value. And aspects of freedom are still central to who I think I am, but you know, you see it used all over the place in ways that are just kind of horrifying. And so that had been kicking around my head, and I was trying to figure out how I might write something about this. And I began to think, if I really want to write this, I need a place. I got to find a place. And this was all in the back of my head. I really wasn't working on anything in particular. I just wrapped up The Great Exception literally months before. The real story, though, is that I was teaching at Cornell then. It was literally 20 below zero. And my poor little shivering children came up to me and said, "Where are we going for spring break?" And I said, I hadn't planned any trips for spring break. And I said, "So you guys plan a trip, make it cheap, and we'll go." So they planned a trip to the Gulf Coast, and we drove down to the Gulf Coast from Ithaca. We got off the main road and drove through Eufaula, which is the biggest town in Barbour County. And I just entered that town. I was like, it's sort of a, you know, staged as this historic town with fancy mansions and beautiful trees arcing over two-lane boulevards, and it's all rich with history. But you could tell, like, as soon as you cross the main boulevard, it all kind of dissolves into kind of, you know, mom and pop shops that are barely keeping it together. I was just kind of tingly. I was like, this place is interesting. There's something underneath the surface here. And I turned to my wife and I said, well, you know, what's going on here? And I said, Google the name of this town. She says, well, I don't know anything about it, but they had their first integrated prom in 1991. And I was like, all right, there's a story here. And so it was kind of a reporter's impulse, I guess, as much as an historian's impulse. I went back, started doing research on it at the Library of Cornell. And I started, as any good historian would, at the beginning of the story with Indian removal. And it wasn't until months and months later that I realized George Wallace was from the county. And then when I found George Wallace, I was like, oh, this is fate.
Right.
Because he was from a different town in the other corner of the county.
All right. So you begin the book with Wallace and his inaugural address on January 14th, 1963, which is most well known for the infamous phrase, segregation now, segregation today, and segregation forever. But what have we missed about this speech?
So Wallace is from this kind of obscure, gritty little town in the corner of the county. And the way he rises to power is incredible. But when he makes that speech, he has already realized his formula. And his formula is maybe segregation, but really the core of his message, he's only going to get so far in segregation because he has a national agenda, right? So if you really look at that speech, what you see, it's about freedom from federal power. And so he mentions segregation one other time outside of that quote, that famous quote. But he mentions freedom or liberty about two dozen times. That's the core of the speech. And he's not just making a speech to the state of Alabama, but he's making a speech to the nation at that point, that he sees freedom from federal power as not just a Southern thing, but a national thing. And he's essentially launching his presidential campaign that very cold January day. And he's, you know, just so, so much ambition, just raw political ambition and cunning. But if you think about it, he's right. Like, he's only going to get so far on the race question, which he's most famous for. But if you make your argument against the federal government, you're going to get a much bigger, cast a bigger net. You're going to get the anti-tax people. You're going to get the anti-regulation people. Who doesn't hate the federal government? Everybody's got to beef against the federal government, right? It's a great strategy. And Wallace was also a student of Barber County history. He really read a lot of local history, and he knew that the federal government was the enemy going all the way back to the beginning of Southeastern, the white history of Southeastern Alabama.
One of the things that sticks out in the book, as you say, the theme that Wallace has developed there is freedom, and freedom from what he sees as federal tyranny. But in the book, you take this term and concept of freedom and express the positive aspects of it, but you also remind us that there's another definition of freedom, and that's the freedom to dominate others. Where does this concept come from?
The first thing I did was plow through Orlando Patterson's history of freedom in the West, and you know, and he goes all the way back to ancient societies, classical societies, Athens in particular, and looks at the derivation of freedom, and he basically says, freedom is rooted in slavery, right? You can only understand the idea of freedom in the Western framework as not slave, or, so that's one version, not to be a slave, but the other is the capacity to enslave, right? And that's, that sort of opened up my mind on this whole question. And he says freedom is kind of a chord of three notes. There's civil liberty type freedom, Bill of Rights, negative freedom. And then there's the freedom to create a political community, to participate in the building of your political community. And then there's the freedom to dominate others or to have sovereignty over others. And when you take that idea and you stick it into a settler colonial and chattel slavery framework that you have in the American South, that suddenly metastasizes and gets, you know, a lot more virulent, a lot more powerful, that freedom to dominate. And so you see it in the dominating of land and dominating the people who used to have the land, dominating of slaves, dominating of sharecroppers, whatever the case. And that can only happen as long as you can keep the federal government firmly at bay.
Well, and that's what I want to return to in this question or mention here, is that in your introduction and throughout the book, you mentioned that the protagonist of this book, an unlikely and tragically flawed protagonist, is the federal government. What do you mean by that?
Right. I think I call him our weak-kneed, clay-footed hero or something like that in the book. So I'm arguing against the long tradition of state and local rights, because that is where these forms of domination, freedom is domination, happen. Now, the federal government is the sort of weak-kneed hero in the sense that it comes in occasionally and tries to do the right thing, almost every time in a deeply flawed, half-assed way. And in fact, almost to the point of just enough to whip up white fears, white hysteria over federal tyranny and not actually get the job done of protecting the people that they were allegedly there to protect in the first place, whether it's Creek Indians or African Americans or whatever. And so it's a very, very problematic and intricate story of how the federal government works in this local. That's why the local part of this is so important, mm-hmm. is like working out the machinations on the county level. They kind of stirred the pot enough to make everything worse in some ways. But the potential energy there is the only possibility I see, the potential energy of the federal government enacting these laws and controlling and restraining white freedom is the only possible solution to the problems I lay out in the book.
What one concept you point out in the book, and I think it comes from Madison, is this notion of the compound republic, and you return to it at various parts of the book. Could you explain that concept to us?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the great questions Madison had was how are we going to govern this big, huge, sprawling country? Right. Previous democracies had been city states. How is this going to work? And so this idea of the compound republic, that this is going to be an local, state and federal power working in this, you know, orchestrated dynamic that'll have a sort of creative tension to it. We'll have these multi levels of power, was his solution. And, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it ends in civil war. What I look at, I mean, the key parts of the story, which I more or less tell in four parts, is really where that compound republic is at war with itself, where the clashes over authority are happening, and it's at those friction points that the idea of freedom is really sort of comes to the fore, where local whites demand their freedom from federal authority, demand to be able to do whatever they want with local lands, local peoples, local labor rights, local whatever it is that is kind of up against this kind of constant threat, this constant fear of sort of federal bayonets that are always kind of mythologically poised right over the hillside that are going to come in and take away white people's freedom to dominate others.
In book one, or the first section, the book abounds with ironies, to say the least. And for example, we usually think of Andrew Jackson as leading the Indian removal policy in the Deep South. But in the case of the Creeks that you studied in the 1830s, he's actually protecting their land from white intruders. How did this happen?
Let's be clear. So what happens in the early mid 1830s happens after Jackson's campaigns, which essentially turn the better part of several states over to white people, steals it from Creek, Choctaw, Cherokee, and other people. But what we have by the time this book opens is this nine-county region on the western bank of the Chattahoochee River. The Chattahoochee divides Alabama and Georgia. And by treaty, the Treaty of Cusseta, the Creek people have this land. It's theirs. And for 5 years, the treaty says there won't be any white intruders in this land, and that they will be sort of protected. And in the meantime, the land will be kind of privatized, moved from a tribal communal base and privatized and given to the hands of individual Creeks. So the Creeks there, they're like, okay, you know, we're beleaguered, defeated people. We'll take this, and we'll take 5 years of protection, and we'll take this privatization scheme and try and allow our culture and customs to survive. Well, the unwashed democratic masses of America don't necessarily, they see this as the firing starting gun for a land grab. Instead, they're like, oh, this treaty's been signed, let's go. And so they swarm into that 9-county area, and Barber County is the southernmost county in that region, actually. So Jackson gets angry at this and basically sends federal marshals in to kick white people out of the Creek Nation. And it's called the Creek Nation by the federal government. And so you have this extraordinary moment where these white people who are, you know, many newly enfranchised, feeling their democratic power, seizing land as promised by Jefferson, as promised by Jackson. This is the American vision. I'm going to go get mine. You have their hero, Old Hickory, basically saying, nope. And so the first act that actually happens in this town, barely a white, it's like a tiny white settlement. And the federal marshals come in, set fire to this warehouse they're building, kick everybody out, and drive everybody out of the county. It's completely against the main story of Andrew Jackson. And in fact, people, when I was writing earlier drafts, would just completely read the opposite story of what I wrote because it didn't compute. So it was sort of, you know, cognitively difficult even for my readers to understand that. So I had to write very, very clearly, carefully, because people were so ready to prime to see Jackson as the villain. And he is the villain, believe me. He's not a nice man. And ultimately, you know, the part of it is just people were going against Jackson's will. And Jackson was a bit of an egomaniac in that regard. So, you know, it wasn't just principles, I don't think. Mm-hmm. But what we see is this town born hating the federal government, right? Mm-hmm. And they turn against Jackson because Jackson is trying to enforce treaty rights that support Creek people. Mm-hmm. It's a great irony, as you say.
You know, one of the key themes here about this white's defense of freedom is that they're victims of the federal government. And for that, you need martyrs. And in this first section, you establish this with a character named Hardiman Owens. Could you tell us a little bit about him?
Hardiman Owens is an amazing story. He's this kind of rascal figure, unsavory guy who was one of the first intruders, and they were called intruders, who come into the Creek Nation and take over land. And he's belligerent, kind of chip on his shoulder sort of fella, and he's a grave robber, and you know, he was just kind of a nasty guy. But in a confrontation with federal authorities, a series of confrontations, including him trying to blow them up with a keg of gunpowder, federal soldiers shoot him and kill him in a completely justified killing, as far as all the evidence suggests. But what you have out of Hardiman Owens is this amazing martyrdom, where he suddenly becomes the first, you know, fighter to fall in the long struggle against federal power. And he becomes this galvanizing figure. And people are talking about marshaling troops against the federal government. And, you know, there's, you know, war plans are beginning to be drawn up, and the governor gets involved. And it's very dramatic, and sort of in this kind of maudlin victimization way, like combined with a certain heroics that he resisted federal power. And so he's the guy that sort of provides the moment for the intruders to identify themselves with a single figure.
Okay, so the white intruders now can move in, they have a justification, and you would assume that this land that they steal basically from the Creek Indian, that it would become these small landowners and they get their family farms, but that's not really what happens at the end of this story. Who actually gets the land?
Right. That's the the ultimate irony of this section, I suppose, is that these speculators come in and sort of win the game. They essentially they are the ones who win, because it begins as kind of a the yeoman farmer myth and ends right. with large scale capitalism and some of the most valuable land in the world at that point in the Black Belt.
All right. As you say, they turn this land over in a very familiar tale to cotton monoculture. They become, you know, well, produces a great amount of wealth. And then, but ultimately leads to an attempt to secede from the United States in the Civil War, which the Confederacy is defeated. And in book two, in the second section, you take a look at a familiar topic of Reconstruction, but with the themes you're using. What happened on Election Day, November 3rd, 1874 in Barbour County, and what was the white line?
Right. So, yeah, the Civil War, you know, real quick on that, you know, the thing that shocked me about this, so you follow Regency or these secessionists in the area, and they were real, real fire eater types. The thing, before I talk about 1874, I just want to drive home, it was 20 years since they won the land before they're, like, ready to secede. It's amazing. It's a generation. A little more than a generation, but not much. Mm-hmm. And it's all draped in glory and history and tradition and all this stuff. But it's the bat of an eye, historically speaking. Mm-hmm. So anyway, these guys are going to defend what they have at all costs. They've already lost the war, but they still need to win control over local politics. By 1874, Reconstruction was working pretty well in Barbour County. There'd been local Black officials elected. They had a Black congressman going to Washington. They had state representatives. And the white locals had been trying to push against this in a variety of ways, politically, and there'd been some terror and other stuff. But finally, they gave up on all possible means, fair and foul, and basically decided they were going to seize this using kind of the logic of the Colfax massacre and draw what was called the white line. And that is that they were going to basically violently seize control of power. And two events happened in Barbour County, one in the main town of Eufaula, where at midday, when all the Black voters had marched in from the rural areas and lined up to vote, they, in an orchestrated manner, white people pulled out weapons from all corners of town and just started opening fire on the Black voters. And this is that kind of thing that we'd never know anything about, or we just have the white story, except there was a federal investigation by the Republican Party. Well, it was bipartisan, but run by the Republicans. But so we have detailed evidence about what happened because of that. And then there was another shooting and poll place burning up in the northern end of the county, where they burned shot the son of a scalawag and judge and burned the votes, and this turned the tide completely on and for 100 years, almost for 90 years, on voting in Barbour County. After that, people were afraid to vote. Republican activists, Black Republicans, were driven out of town, anybody who dared to identify anybody or cross that line ended up going to jail and being leased into the mines.
So during Reconstruction, or at least the early years, as you point out, the Black Republicans in Barbour County and the white scalawags, as they were called by their enemies, did achieve more than just a semblance of democracy. How did this happen exactly?
It's really at the end of those federal bayonets. Reconstruction worked because there was an aggressive federal intervention in this local place promoting democratic norms and institutions, right? Imperfectly, of course. There was corruption, yes, as there always is in politics. But it was a functioning democracy, and it was functioning because there were rules and oversight and power, federal power. And so when those whites seize control back The great irony is they are destroying democratic norms in the name of their own personal freedom and their own freedom to dominate others. And they use that those terms. I'm not imposing this. These are the fighting terms under which they are struggling. Some people want to say this is just rhetoric, but I actually believe that it is a fundamental belief in what the nature of freedom is. It's not just political cover.
So moving on to book three, the Jim Crow era section of the book, which takes it really from post-Reconstruction years through the end of the 19th century and up to World War II, to the dawn of the modern civil rights era. And this is the section of the book where you specifically address labor in at least two occasions. And you have a chapter on convict labor in this area of Alabama. And my assumption is that this flourished because the federal government had receded here. And yet you show in the book that it did become an issue for the federal government. How did that happen exactly?
Yeah, so I call this section the federal government in repose, that this is the era in which, certainly compared to Reconstruction and certainly compared to the New Deal where it ends, it is in repose. It is pulling back. The use of convict labor, which is, you know, well documented in a variety of our colleagues' work, comes to the forefront for the federal government in a funny way, and in a way that I think, you know, this sort of compromised, pragmatic sort of politics that flies in the face of the sort of politics of purity we often see in progressive politics today. I mean, this, you know, Booker T. Washington is close to or has connections to Theodore Roosevelt, and Booker T. Washington sees a sort of moderate segregationist who still believes in democracy, and he says, "Hey, Theodore Roosevelt, you should choose this guy for the federal bench." And there is no good character in this story, but he begins to sort of hear these cases against convict leasing, and there are federal investigations of convict leasing by the turn of the century. And but again, there's a sort of recurring character in different forms throughout the book that are sort of these milquetoast people who have the right idea but can't quite deliver. And that's what we see in those federal cases. And it's really not until a couple decades later in the 20th century that the institution begins to die.
Yeah, and the descriptions you have of convict labor are some of the most gruesome conditions they worked in. I mean, they were working them to their death in a, you know, variety of different occupations and making a lot of money for the locals. You know, what you do show or illustrate is just the sadistic nature of what the system had wrought, especially by those who are running it and reaping the benefits of it, and then defending it in court,
right,
when there's any attempt at reform by these local judges who are federal judges, that they're defending it in the name of freedom.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. And just like a lot, all sorts of exploitation of workers, of, you know, everything is defended on the names of freedom. I do want to explain one thing to listeners, which is that there are no mines in Barber County. Yeah, that the mines are up in Birmingham, a long way away from Barber County. But the kingpin in the convict leasing system, this guy, talk about sadistic, he used that word, J.W. Comer, who's one of the biggest planting families in Barber County. He is the guy who kind of orchestrates and runs the convict leasing systems, has people running around all the county jails and buying up convicts to send to the mines. And as you say, the most horrific and at times just sort of gratuitously sadistic setting. Mm-hmm. This is an opportunity, or this is a setting where somebody like Comer, who is just has something wrong with him, can let his freedom fly, right? In the form of just brutalizing other human beings. And the whole Comer family that comes from Barber County plays sort of different aspects of the story of freedom in Alabama.
Well, speaking of the Comer family, we find another one of them several decades later, in which you return to a familiar era for labor historians and labor historians in the South. And that's during the 1930s, the NRA period, and when the New Deal comes to the South. And so we have Donald Comer, who is is he the son or the
nephew of J.W.
Yeah, the nephew. And he is a textile magnate, runs a series of mills, including one in Eufaula, if that's correct.
That's right. You know, it's an interesting case because, paternalism is a question that defines many aspects of our field of labor history. And, and he bought up, well, his dad, actually. His dad gave it all to him, B.B. Comer, who's the governor. He took this grimy, disgusting, horrible, disease-filled mill, like the worst of, the dark satanic mills, and turned it into kind of a nice place. I really sort of struggled with this question of what did this mean? He, gave everybody nice uniforms and put in bathrooms instead of one outhouse and fresh drinking water and clean air and ran on electricity instead of coal and, spiffed it all up. And everybody loved Mr. Donald. They absolutely loved this guy. He embraced the early New Deal. He embraced the first New Deal, began and was on the textile board and during the National Industrial Recovery Act and all that kind of stuff. And so, what do you do with that? Here's a person who kind of used his freedom from the federal power in a fairly effective way, a fairly more than benign, a fairly generous way, more generous than he had to be. He was sort of a Christian gospel kind of or social gospel, figure. But then when the second New Deal comes along and it's actually about empowering workers and it's actually about providing unionization rights and collective bargaining and stuff that doesn't necessarily empower him, but empower his workers to say what they want rather than him telling them what he wants, he fights off unionization elsewhere. In his other plants in Eufaula, they're basically by his side all the way.
Yeah, you call this system enlightened paternalism, and this and that may have been the term they used at the time. I don't know, but that has been an issue when, especially studying the textile industry in this time. And where some historians are just flat out critics of it and see it as a mere tool for domination, particularly of the poor whites who were sharecroppers and tenant farmers and did move into industry and become a working class. And then there's another side of this coin where paternalism is seen as a method that workers themselves were able to manipulate and carve out some spaces of cooperation, of making their workplace better. But you offer, I think, a little twist on both those that I don't think you'd necessarily deny that was the case, but you use your theme to reinterpret or explain the way you see how paternalism works. Could you expand on that a bit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What made writing about this and coming up with the argument about this a little more tricky was this was kind of a golden version of paternalism. This wasn't just, hey, do you want a ham at Christmas kind of thing. This was, they had a summer camp on the coast and they had bands. They had a band and a baseball team and decent pay. And it would be condescending to say anything besides that the workers really liked this guy. And I think it's not our job to say otherwise. But what it did do, and I think this is what you're driving at, is it kept the federal government out of regulating industrial work. While Mr. Donald Comer, used that freedom fairly effectively, or fairly generously, perhaps, the long impact is essentially, and that is the key to Southern history in a lot of ways, is to keep federal government out of their affairs. And that got really aggressive. I mean, he got blatant about it with the Second New Deal and on into the 1940s and 1950s, especially the FEPC. And so what you see is sort of that also, his very nice example also becomes cover for a whole lot of other really bad behavior that allows simultaneously freedom from federal authority allows you to run your plan as you want. Now that could be run well, like Donald Comer's plants, or run really in bad ways, as many, many other places were.
So when we move to book four, I mean, one thing you've shown here is Barber County is kind of the farm system or the breeding ground for Alabama white politicians. And not just a series of governors, but probably the most famous to come out of this era or this area is George Wallace. You know, the first question I ask, how was he a product of Barber County, and what were his particular strengths as a politician?
His most cherished memory as a child is vote counting. You know, when his grandfather ran for, it eludes me what it was, judge or something, commissioner or something, and they're up all night counting the votes, and he's just looking at the chalkboard, and it's just the most exciting thing he's ever seen. And he begins already in this little town of Clyle, pumping fists at an early age and talking to people and schmoozing. And then at this time, the other side of it, of course, is that Wallace was a fairly reputable boxer, right? So he's a fighter, he's scrappy. And you put those two together and you have quite a character. And early on, he became an aide, legislative aide in the state legislature. As a teenager, and he wrote every single member of the state legislature to introduce himself. My name's George Wallace. I'm from Barber County. And stood on that famous star where Jefferson Davis was sworn in as president of the Confederacy and said, I will be governor one day. And so he's got it in his soul. He's got it in his family. He has it in his boxing. And he has it in Barber County, right? So Barber County, you know, I make a joke in the book somewhere that Tuscaloosa has football, Muscle Shoals has music, and Barber County has politics. Half a dozen governors came from Barber County, and it is a political town. And he just ate it up. So he was a political beast. In his heartbeat politics, blood pump politics, he's just like, it's who he was. And he begins kind of as a vaguely progressive, I'm going to pave the roads and create trade schools, and I'm going to be kind of, you know, I'm not going to play the race card. I'm going to be moderate on race. But he worked his ass off. You know, he didn't have a car. He'd hitchhike all over the county, meeting people, getting rides, whatever it took, and, you know, gets elected and then finally gets a judgeship for the three county area, including Barber County. And that's when he becomes the fighting judge of Alabama.
So you say he was a protege of Big Jim Folsom in the book.
Right.
What would have passed for a Southern moderate or vaguely liberal? Again, not challenging the color line.
But then, you know, once Brown versus Board drops, then the game changes. Like the federal government comes in and says it's time to integrate. And then new lines are drawn. And that kind of space that Folsom and Wallace hold, slightly ambiguous, moderate on race, we're not going to have politics revolve around race, and we're not just going to race bait, that falls by the wayside. And there's much less room for moderation at the time.
Yeah. And so Wallace, you know, sees which way the wind is blowing as far as the local white politics in the wake of Brown. And, you know, we have the famous episode where he decides he won't lose to a segregationist again, in rather colorful language.
I was going to say, that was a pretty clean telling of that story.
Right. And, you know, so he looks like, from all appearances, that he's going to be an Orville Faubus or one of these, you know, the last gasp of these overt segregationist governors. But that doesn't happen to Wallace. He's the one of all of them. I mean, I guess you could say Strom Thurmond in some way as well. But Wallace is the one who emerges, you know, with a movement behind him. Thurmond kind of folds into the Republican Party as it's changing. Wallace stands out. And why is that?
I mean, I actually think it's his genius to move towards this idea of freedom. And that, I mean, and he's just good. I mean, he's just plain good, right? But I think he has that national ambition, and he sees that use and mobilization of anti-statist sentiments across the country as super powerful. But he learns something really clever, I think, in the late 50s and early 60s. And that is, every time he loses on everything, he loses everything, you know, every political fight he loses, but every time he does, he comes out swinging against the federal government. He just keeps losing forward, right? If you know, his big standoff is with the Federal Elections Committee in 58, and where they want the ballots in Barber County, and he won't give them to him, but he ends up giving them to him. But then he's able to fight. That's when he wins the moniker, the fighting judge, because he's the resistor against federal power, even though he completely lost the fight. And so throughout his career, he translates those losses, the Civil Rights Act, somewhat the Voting Rights Act, into, I'm your man. I'm going to keep fighting these guys. I'm going to keep fighting this intrusion, and I'm going to defend your freedom. And it's that and a lot of hard work and corruption.
So Wallace establishes this model, or discovers this model, that it's not actually posting victories, but always being a moving target or always being a victim in the protection of your supporters' freedom from tyranny. And which not only can play in the South very well among the white segregationists, but he finds it can be transposed throughout the nation. And I would even add, it can be transposed through time up to the present.
It's the enduring theme throughout the entire book, all the way going back to the Intruders' War.
I mean, he's never chastened by an apparent loss or defeat and will never admit it.
It's all opportunity, and until he has a sort of conversion moment later on.
Also in book four, the final section, it's not just the an analysis of Wallace, but you examine voter registration drives in Barber County and throughout Alabama and the South in general, especially through the SCLC Scope campaign and SNCC as well, their voter drives, along with the heroic efforts, I think the book includes as well, on the part of local female activists here who really carry the ball for the voter drives in these areas. One unsung hero of this era is the attorney politician Fred Gray, who we know, if you're familiar with the Montgomery bus boycott, was the lead attorney in the federal court cases that actually did end segregation on municipal buses. And his life and career stands in counterpoint to Wallace, the way you present it. Could you tell us a bit about Fred Gray during the period you examine in the book? You know, we know about him in the 50s. What happens to him in the 60s and the story you tell?
Yeah, that's a really interesting comparison with Wallace and Gray. I hadn't really kind of thought of, I mean, they're clearly diametrically opposed sort of characters. Yeah, I mean, Gray is young, he's earnest, hardworking, believes in the law, avoids the flash and the substance. And when he does run for office, not having enough bombast is his whole problem. He needs gospel singers even to get his word out, right? And he just grinds through the courts and just taking on case after case of disenfranchisement and the schools and he's in and out of Barber County all the time and voting rights cases. The desegregation of schools doesn't happen the better part of two decades to actually desegregate those schools. And he finally runs for the state house in Alabama. And he technically wins in 66, but then there's a runoff and it doesn't work. And then he runs again and they steal from him. And finally, in 1970, he wins and he's the first one of two people who become the first Black representatives elected since Reconstruction. Like, you know, he doesn't talk about freedom, even though he's practicing the idea of freedom we talk about, right? He's talking about rules, institutions, laws, boring, hard work stuff, not just beating your breast about freedom.
Yeah, and from his perspective, and as you write that, you know, citizenship and true citizenship rights, that Gray is devoted to this idea that you need the power to give it. What Wallace and them are seeing as unfair power or tyranny, Gray sees this as a guarantee.
That's right.
Of yeah. citizenship and of rights.
It's the tension throughout the whole book.
Yes.
What will the federal government guarantee here? Mm-hmm. And that's what he keeps going to court to find out, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a long battle. Mm-hmm. The point for me that really crystallized everything about this, and this isn't really about Fred Gray directly, but indirectly, and that is after the Voting Rights Act of 65, and the scope organizers are trying to organize voters, get voters registered, which is a huge thing. And this, you know, one of these classic places that nobody's ever studied before. The vast majority of people weren't in Selma or Montgomery or Memphis or wherever, right? They're just in places nobody's ever thought about with the civil rights movement. They had a decent campaign, but when the numbers get back to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Atlanta on these county level registration drives, they can't figure out why some are better than others. And Hosea Williams is kind of the SCLC lieutenant on this. And he looks at Barbara County. He's like, they got a decent movement. How come their numbers are so low? And then Wilcox County right nearby has not as good a movement, but their numbers are better. And then finally he puts it all together and realizes federal registrars, the presence of a federal authority in those counties, that is the enemy of white people, the enemy of white freedom, is the key to solid numbers. So you can have all the activists in the world, but until you get the federal government in there. And that's really what so much of the civil rights movement was about, really. It was trying to trigger federal authority to come in, to make black people federal, not state and local citizens, right? If you could make a claim on federal citizenship under the Voting Rights Act, under the 14th Amendment, whatever it's going to be, that was the win, and that's what Fred Gray totally understood.
Mm-hmm. I almost think if you could summarize this, especially the position of those who wanted to maintain segregation, I think the usual view is their argument is the federal government is coming here to interfere with our power to dominate. And your reinterpretation of this is it's coming in to prevent our freedom to dominate. So they're putting it in this glorious terms, you know, deeply rooted in American culture. And who's going to, as you ask, I think rhetorically, who's going to oppose freedom? Right? It's always a good thing, right? And I think what the book does is really complicate this concept and shows what that it isn't an unalloyed concept of human liberation, that it actually can be wielded in a way that makes lives of voters, of workers, and of, you know, all people who don't possess power, make their lives a lot harder. I do think this is a bold move to subject that concept to more scrutiny than we have. All right, let's bring this all together here. And I have two points I want to make. First is that in every section of the book, there's a twist or irony. On one hand, Barbara County White's anti-statism and quest for freedom applies to all white residents, that they're going to benefit from freedom's dominion. But it always seems like an elite group ends up ahead at the expense of the poorer and less powerful whites. Do you see freedom's dominion as a form of elite manipulation, or is it something else?
Yeah, I think it's very insightful, Dave. In each case, more or less, you kind of have a coalition around whiteness that slips pretty quickly into an elite domination of the question of whiteness. During the land grab, obviously the speculators win. But the one that is most profound to me is after the 1901 segregationist constitution, where they essentially, whites agree to lose the vote themselves, and more whites over the course of the ensuing decades lose the vote than blacks, basically. And they give that up. They cough that up. And that gives more money to the planters and the big mules, that is the economic elite of the state of Alabama. And so, yeah, I do agree. But it kind of, there's a, it doesn't necessarily start that way. There is a kind of, I hesitate to use the word solidarity, but there's a unity around the question of whiteness, but that readily evolves into a domination of economic elites. It's a very hierarchical society, very highly mm-hmm. stratified, right? So it's not surprising that happens.
Yeah, and it's a familiar story even today that you'll see those who are adapting Wallace's populist style, for lack of a better term, to the present will use these terms, will base their whole political campaigns on their opposition to federal power. And yet, as they keep getting reelected and reelected, you don't see much improvement, especially in the poorer areas, in the poorer parts of the Deep South. The winners are very clearly delineated. So it does serve, and I think you're very convincing in the book that they're, like you say, a unity of interest. This isn't false consciousness, and yet on the parts of the poorer whites, and they're as wedded to this concept of freedom. But once that is established, the federal government is defeated, loses its nerve, beat back, then that sets the terrain for this process of now the economic elites can take advantage of this new context.
Yeah, it's less false consciousness than an eternal false promise, right? That if we can just achieve this,
yeah,
then the new day dawns, right? And
yeah,
what happens is those in power essentially remain in power.
You close with an emphatic defense of the use of federal power. Where in history, in this history, can we draw any glimmer of such a thing being realized? And I mention that because today we're seeing, particularly among Southern workers, a nascent uprising for unionization, for demands of better working conditions, for things like healthcare, for even, respect of individuals, for even climate change. You're starting to see signs of this coming from workers across class, cross-racial coalitions. And it seems to me this book does speak to these times for workers in those conditions. Where is there any glimmer of hope? Or maybe it has to be something new.
Right. So there a cynical read of this book, I think, would be the federal government came in just long enough to stir everything up and whip up a sense of white freedom and white, resistance to federal power. It never delivered the goods. It never closed the deal for non-white or white working class people. And I think it's a fairly legitimate argument. But the potential energy, I think, of federal intervention is kind of the only hope. And I think you see it in the initial phases of the marshals trying to remove white intruders. I think you see it in the first 10 years or 8-9 years of Reconstruction when black voting is supported. I think you see it in attempts to integrate production and regulate under the FEPC and regulate the labor market, provide unionization during the New Deal and World War II. And you certainly see it during the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act. Obviously, we're in another period of long redemption from the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act period. But it's the only tool. It's the only, if somebody wants to show me another possibility that will provide a lever outside of local circumstances that can provide people the capacity to act upon themselves and to have agency over their circumstances that is not federal authority, I'm all ears, but I don't see it.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff, for talking about your book, for agreeing to be one of our first, if not the first guest of the relaunch of Working History. And, as I've told you, I think this book is just a great achievement. I think it can be used in coursework. I think it can be read by anybody with an interest in history. I think it's a retelling of the past. It also speaks to our present. And thank you for being so generous with your time and your comments.
Well, I appreciate you being such an astute reader, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to Working History, a podcast on the New Books Network channel, New Books in the American South. Email us at workinghistorypodcast@gmail.com and find us on Twitter at Working History.
Working History is a production of the Southern Labor Studies Association. Learn more and become a member at www.southernlaborstudies.org. Thanks for listening.